October 2006, the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority, as project manager in conjunction with Vic Roads, opened a new concrete bridge across the Murray River between the towns of Euston, New South Wales, and Robinvale, Victoria. The new bridge and its approaches across the floodplain replaced an old timber and steel structure built in the 1920s, which had reached the end of its useful life. This compilation CD is part of an oral history project commissioned by the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority that documents the construction of the old and the new crossings and gives an account of life in Euston and Robinvale through the memories of residents and others interviewed for the project. Darcy Pettit is one of those interviewed. He gives an account of the original Indigenous population of the area.
The original people from here were the Tatti Tatti people. They were mostly based around from Lake Benanee right through to Euston, right through this part of the country. The original mob was a breakaway mob from the Wiradjuri tribe in New South Wales. And then you had the Latchi Latchi people. But the Latchi Latchi people were more Colkine way. But the Tatti Tatti people were the original people from here. In the early days, when the squatters and everything moved in and started taking the land, with the introduction of smallpox down through the river tribes, the strongest ones, of course, the runners, ran on with a message to the next tribe, and then little did they know they were carrying smallpox with them, but that's the way it spread right up through the river and killed them in masses of thousands and thousands, along with a lot of massacres and gun battles. Well, spears against guns, and it just don't work.
All through the 19th century and into the 20th, the settler communities were heavily dependent on the river trade. Len Arnott is one of the earliest residents of Robinvale. How dependent was Robinvale, say, on passing river trade?
It was tremendously. Euston more so than Robinvale, because Robinvale, up until after the First War in particular, was virtually a sheep station. So there wasn't much at Robinvale, whereas Euston had a thriving town. When Edmund Morais opened up Euston Station in 1847, a bit of debate, 46, 47, but Euston started after that in the early 50s, and by 1853 there was quite an established town. By 1865 they had a school, a courthouse, a tax office, two hotels, and Euston was quite an established area. But it relied purely on the riverboats, carrying the wheat, carrying the wool, carrying the supplies, timber for them. But then once the railway and the road transport set up, that was the death knell for Euston, and to a degree the death knell for any river tribe at Robinvale.
Stan Park has lived in Robinvale since he was brought there by a Cobb & Co. coach in 1923.
I can remember the Ruby and the Melbourne. We used to go down and watch them go past, pulling barges of wool and filling up with firewood and that sort of thing. They used to give us a hoot as they went past, with the kids waving on the bank.
Val McGinty's parents ran the dairy at Robinvale and later at Euston.
When we first came to Robinvale, the steamers used to regularly run down the Murray. And there are times if we had a calf born on that morning, the calf would be named after the boat that went down that morning, maybe the Ruby or Marion or what.
Bill McGinty grew up in Euston, which experienced water shortages during periods of prolonged droughts.
I can remember at Euston, if there had been a strong wind, it would have picked Euston up and taken it away with the number of windmills that were there. Everyone had a windmill. All you could see were windmills. And they had wells that went down around about 10 metres. And some good water, mostly bad water.
There wasn't much more at Robinvale in those pioneering times. Stan Park remembers.
When we first came here, there was just a wine shanty, I think. That's about all there was. And there was the old homestead of Bunbank Station.
When you say wine shanty, what do you mean, a hotel?
No, just a a hut that dispensed wine. That's about what it was. Oh, and then as the years went by, we got a garage and a grocery store and a baker and butcher. You know, they just come along as the years went by.
Robin Vale was named in memory of Robin Cuttle, a First World War pilot and member of the Cuttle family, prominent in the town.
He was shot down over Villers Bretonneux, in Kay actually, just out of Villers Bretonneux, and the town was named after Robin. And I think from memory, on the station, they had Vale Robin, something like that. They'd had it in flowers.
In flowers, when the train came up for the first land sale, they had it decorated in flowers on Hessian and in the flowers.
That's how it got its name.
Bill Peart was born in 1913 and recalls what Robin Vale consisted of in 1925 on his arrival in the town.
There was Cuttle's Mallee store. He had about six shops through at the Mallee. Then there was the post office, tin place. Jack Cockrell was a bloke that managed it. Only a small tin place, and he camped in a tent near it. And they just finished the two row of houses. That's about it. Houses there. And then that was on. There was a big tin hall there. Cuttle built it and it's used as a storeroom and as our school. Oh, no, there was only a few places here.
Val McGinty worked for Mr. Herbert Cuttle at Robin Vale.
He had a big building, and in the building he had hardware, he had electrical, all the growers' products, two different fuel agencies, and he had radio. Then on the side of that he had the office. That's where I worked. And he had immigration, naturalisation, tourist bureau, three different insurance agencies. Then up the street, a little further in Herbert Street, there was a timber yard. A bit further up in Herbert Street was a garage. He also sold cars and tractors. Then up further, he had a plumbing department, made tanks, rainwater tanks, and I was his bookkeeper.
In 1923, work began on the construction of a wooden and steel lift-span railway bridge across the river between Euston and Robin Vale.
We come up here on the 25th, or the first Saturday in April 1925. Well, the bridge is started. They had earthworks done a bit on this side, and they had putting a railway line in, putting a spur line in.
When you were a kid, yeah. How often would you go and have a look at the bridge being built?
Oh, the damn near daily we'd go past. We had three or four cows and we had a milk run. And those kids used to have to deliver it to some of the people that lived on the work on the bridge, that type of stuff, you see, down as far as the Victorian side of Euston, deliver milk. And you went past the bridge and you saw them there and you couldn't do much because you'd get a kick at the backside. You'd get in the road of all the equipment. You'd see an extra pile of tubing bashed in, that type of stuff, and different work started. They had the horse-drawn scoops and ploughs to rip it up with the ground to form all this formation on the side, and steam was their power. There was no electricity at Robin Vale then.
Bill Peart's father worked on the construction of the bridge.
He was a cluey bloke, Dad was. He was given a job as a boss, as a gagger or whatever you like to call him, and his job was to be getting gravel for the top of the bridge, you see, and he went out and had the gang there, digging gravel on Euston Station there. But What they done, they started to drive a few wooden piles in the side. Well, it took a while, it looked pretty rough too. Some was steamed close to it and others was pulled up with a horse, let drop in a big hammer, weighed about 3 ton. And that was built out, and another side they had to do a bit too, but then they started on the concrete, you know, what's there now, for the bridge itself. Well, they drove in piles in a top of a circle to make it waterproof so they could pump it out and put the concrete foundations in. Yeah, I think they mixed the foundations up out there, and and beside the thing too, they put in another little type of a, not a bridge, but a place where they could go out to the lift span out there.
Bill, I believe two men actually died constructing the bridge. Do you know anything about that? Could you tell me something about that?
Yes, and also, but there was a woman that died too. Yes, not on working there, but her husband was. His name was Jim, I think. They had their camp down there, near the Punt Road down there. And she was home there, and so the fire was outside, open fire, you see. And she, they had a tent, and then they had a gum leaf stuff over the top to make a bit of shade, you see, that type of stuff. But anyway, one day apparently that caught fire, and she apparently rushed in and got her baby and came out. She was on fire a bit, but there were some people lived close by, naming Hughes. The boys rushed across, and she was screaming out, "Save my baby, save my baby." She had it in her arms, seeing her clothes were burning, had them long dresses them times, and she threw it at him and he caught it. But she died, and she was the wife of one of the workers. He was at work that day. He came home and there was nothing there.
In March of 1928, the bridge was launched. Stan Park, then only 7, was there on that day.
All the dignitaries were saddled at the station, and then we all got on the train, and the train huffed and puffed across the bridge to the siding on the other side. When at the siding that they went to, the only passenger there was one of Paddy McGinty's goats. Yeah, that's the only one there. And then we come back again, yeah.
The crossing became the vital link to connect the people of Euston and Robinvale. Bill McGinty remembers.
There was an old chap in Euston, and he had horses and drays. And he would come to Robinvale each Saturday morning when the train came in, and he would more or less unload the train and deliver it around the town. And I was one of his drivers. I was about 10. We had two wagons. And before we left at about 6 o'clock in the morning to drive over to Robinvale, he would roll me a cigarette. And I'd be sitting up there, puffing away at this cigarette, driving the horses across, very proud of myself, 10 years of age with a smoke. And when we got here, we'd take all the beer in barrels to the hotel, put it down the cellar. When that was finished, he would go in and he'd get me a raspberry drink, made with lemonade, which I'd never had in my life, and I used to wonder what made it sparkle, and I'd drink it very slowly to get rid of it, and I thought that was the great thing for the day.
Len Arnott discusses his perceptions of the purpose of the bridge.
I'm a little bit vague about this. My impression is that the train went across when there was wheat or wool or sufficient produce to warrant a trip, which was only once or twice a year, I think. Darkie Nolan, the train driver, used to pay my brother and I 1 penny each to open the gates. There used to be gates which shut off the rail traffic and let the train through. So Darkie would arrange with Dad that my brother and I would get in to the bridge, and he'd toot the train horn, the whistle, and we'd swing the gates around and he'd go through. And we used to get a penny for doing that on occasions. But my memory of it, the train only went across the bridge once or twice a year. But it was an integral part of life to get to Euston, to get to Mildura, Balranald, or where we're going. When I was going to school, on more than one occasion, the train would be travelling from Melbourne to Robinvale. And, of course, it'd leave Melbourne a full train. And the further you got north, the less people there were. It wasn't uncommon. By the time you got up nearing Robinvale, I'd be the only person on the train. So you get out of the passenger compartment, get in the guard's van, and help him sort the parcels into crates. And on more than one occasion, he's handed me a shovel screw and he said, "We've got to clean the line." So he actually shovel the sand off the line so the train can get through. So then we get to Menangatang, which is about 35 k's down the road, a bit more. And once I'd unloaded the parcels, the train crew would go across to a pub to have a bit of a drink. And of course, being a school kid, I wasn't allowed to go in the pub, so I'd walk down the streets of Menangatang at night time, we'd lay down a drink, and then we'd get back on the train and off we'd go again.
Darcy, what sort of memories do you have of playing around the bridge and the river as a kid and maybe as a young adult, working there? Can you
I suppose it started out with curiosity once again. What the birds were doing. So we got up underneath the bridge. We actually got the young swallows, we used to eat them. The eggs, we used to eat those. Then the pigeons moved in, so we've continued to eat the pigeons and climbing up, and we used to go across the river underneath the bridge by the pylons and crawling along the steelwork. And then one day I decided to dive off the bridge, so I dived off the bridge, and then we got game enough. My little mate, he said, "Well, let's go right up the top." It was 80-odd feet up at the top section, and they closed the ladder off now, but it wasn't just me and anybody else. There was quite a few of the locals just to dive off the first layer, but it took the ratties like myself and my mate, Mad Dog, to actually dive off the top of the bridge, but... I did a bit of work with Balranald DMR at the time, I think, repairing the old bridge, and between shearing jobs and working on sawmills and whatnot.
In the 1930s, the Great Depression hit Euston and Robinvale, and life became that much harder. Stan Park comments.
Well, it wasn't all that tough with us. I mean, to say my mother was a pretty good housekeeper, and we used to grind our own porridge, and she used to make her own bread. But there was quite a few people that she fed that were on the road at that time, sometimes in a horse and jinker and sometimes walking alone. Yeah. You know, families used to come in a horse and cart and get a handout, you know, like you get the billy of tea and some scones, as she used to be always making scones, yeah. And we used to trade with, say, an apple grower, you know, for a bag of wheat we'd get so many apples and that sort of thing, yeah. There wasn't any money about. Yeah.
Trevor Wild found his own source of food.
Well, I used to go trapping rabbits out where all the blocks were out, the 246 soldier settlement blocks out there. And that was used to be my trapping country when I was a kid, to catch a few rabbits to eat. There was no roads made or anything. It was just dust, and that was about it. There was very little in Robinvale. There was just one main street.
And what did the crossing itself look like, the bridge? It would have been fairly new then.
Yes, it was very good, yeah, really good. There was practically no traffic here in those days. Like the roads, you could quite often of a Sunday afternoon we'd walk over the bridge just for the afternoon sort of thing, and you wouldn't see a car. You'd be there for probably for 2 or 3 hours, you wouldn't even see a car.
How many times do you think you might have crossed that bridge?
Well, I lived in Euston. I would have been... I used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to do a milk run, and came across, then back again, And then Betty would bring the kids over to school later on and pick them up and take them back again. I couldn't imagine just how many times I went across that bridge, backwards and forwards, twice anyway, most days.
In 1939, the war came to Australia, as Bill and Val McGinty recall.
We were going to school, of course. Well, one thing I missed out on at school was sewing, because they used to send up all the wool from Melbourne, and we had to knit. We had to knit scarves, we had to knit socks, we had to knit all the things that could be sent overseas to our soldiers. So that was our sewing for a number of years.
What, in khaki colours, you mean?
Oh, yes. And, of course, the Air Force, there's the blue, you know, dark navy. We used to get so tired of the scarves, and they had to be a certain length that one girl would get on one end and the other on another to give it a stretch every now and again. We'd get so sick of this khaki wool.
What about you, Bill? What did you do during the war?
I used to knit socks, and we weren't old enough to go to the war. Thank God for that. But I had cousins that went to war, and most of them never came back. But my family consisted of 10, 9 boys and 1 girl. And my auntie, I'd go and stay with my auntie, and she taught me to knit. So I'd sit up all night knitting these socks. And I knitted many pairs of socks, I can assure you. And I also had a go at the scarves. I did those. But that's what we used to do to fill in time. And during the war, I can remember my father, he had a mob of goats. And he had a mob of goats, so we had to feed lambs that my uncle would give us and raise them so as we could eat them. And we had rabbit every way possible. Stewed, grilled, fried, you name it, we had it. But my mother was the best cook in the world. She was fantastic. And she had to be with 10 kids. If you can imagine 10 kids sitting around a table with a great plate of porridge every morning. That's true. That's what we did. Well, 12 of us, rather. We would sit around this table with all this porridge, but nevertheless, we survived.
During the war, Kay Gross arrived at Robinvale to become a teacher at the public school.
I think it was the 2nd of February 1943. It was a long trip from Melbourne. I remember that I caught the train in Melbourne at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I arrived at Robinvale sometime after 10 o'clock. I think it was 10:30 that night. And when I arrived, I was greeted by the head teacher of the school and the chairman of the school committee. And they conveyed me and my baggage down to Robinvale Hotel. And it's quite dark, and I'm looking out, and the headlights of the car depicted just sand, rippling sand like a seashore, right to the very door of the hotel. But I was amazed at the hotel, a two-story hotel. Must be a big place, Robinvale. And when I woke up in the morning and was able to look out the window, all I could see was just red soil because we're in the drought, in the middle of a drought, and many roads all running to the hotel, or rather I should say tracks running to the hotel, almost as if the hotel was the centre of a web. And the lady who was the proprietor of the hotel pointed out to me from the balcony where the school was. And I walked to the school that morning over sand, rippling sand. And I remember arriving at the school gate and discovering that the school gate was perpetually open. And indeed, having a gate was unnecessary because you could step over the fence. That was the sort of conditions that I found there.
The next day, Kay had her first sight of the bridge.
I only saw one train go over the bridge because the year that I came, is, I understand, the last year that, in March of that year, the last time, according to the railway authorities, that they have waybills for goods on that line. That was the last train that they have record of. I came in 43 in February, and the last train was in March. Now, I understand that the trains ran over the bridge every week. The goods train arrived on a Saturday to Robin Vale and went out to Benanee on Sunday, out and back. Sometimes they would take trucks out and leave them there to be loaded with, say, sheep or mallee roots. It seemed to be the chief things that came in. And in season, of course, when there was a season of grain, they had grain trucks, of course.
Now, the train stopped running in 43 across that bridge. So what happened to the bridge, and what was the importance of the bridge to the community after that time?
Well, it continued to be very important to all of us because Euston and Robin Vale were always almost as one community, because the store we had at that time, the general store, there was one in Robin Vale, but the bigger one in Euston. Fisher stores established themselves there. There were two pubs over at Euston and one in Robin Vale. So if one wanted a little variety, one went over to Euston. We would go over there to dances. Once a week we contrived somehow to have a dance. And often the girls had to dance together because there weren't too many fellas left in the district. There were so many away. Every family seemed to have someone away at the war. Yes, that's how it was.
The immediate post-war years ushered in a period of shortages, and good quality housing and building materials were difficult to obtain. Bill and Val McGinty built their first house, which started off with just a kitchen, a bedroom, and the beginnings of a bathroom.
Between the rails, or the studs where they put the flooring on, the bath sat in between that with a bucket under it. You would carry in the water. From the copper. And fill your bath, and then carry it out after you've had your bath, sitting in an unlined room between these rails. The bath fitted nicely in there. It was a great spot for it. But we were quite happy. We had a stove that you could open up in the winter, and you'd sit around that with a rug around you, and it was quite warm. We didn't have any underfloor heating like we've got today or anything like that, but we did well.
We have had 51 years of a happy life.
In 1947, the authorities encouraged the people of Robin Vale to develop a table grape industry and gave them title to land under the Soldier Settlement Scheme. Jenny Black gives an account of her life as the wife of a soldier settler.
Well, it was interesting. We were married in 1950, but before then I knew most of the first and second allocation, and there was not much in Robin Vale in the way of entertainment, so every Friday night they used to have usually rounded Cupper's, Ray Cupper's place, in his shed. We'd all assemble there and we'd take things to eat, and Queenie Harbinson always made little party pies and little sausage rolls, and her food was considered, you know, just a business on a cold night. And we had some beer, and there was a fellow who played the accordion, and there were various people who told stories and had funny skits, and we danced a bit and generally amused ourselves. And that happened on Friday nights fairly regularly. We did a lot of funny things. Nothing was ever too hard, nothing was ever, everything was unexpected, I think. Some of the vehicles, I know one man, he had to, in those days we still had front end winders, you know, as well as self starters. Sometimes they didn't quite work, so he'd get out with the winding thing and wind it up. But he carried a brick because he had to put a brick on the accelerator while he was out winding it. And then once he got us started, he'd have to race in and release the brick and put his foot on the pedal before it stopped. But they were tied up with number 8 wire, and some of them didn't have a lot of floorboards if they were utilities.
So you'd have holes in the floor?
Yes.
Jean Wilson came to Robinvale in 1946 with her husband to set up the town's first pharmacy. By the 1950s, Robinvale was starting to grow.
In this town, it's really amazing. Half the things were built with voluntary labour. Even the nurses, you know, would do odd hours. And we built a baby health centre, swimming pool, tennis court, school ground and all those things. You name it, and it was mostly built by voluntary labour.
Were you expected to really basically volunteer for something?
No, you weren't expected to. That's, you know, not everybody did it, of course, but if you had a family and you knew that they would benefit by what you were doing, you did it.
Jack and Valerie Forbes, also soldier settlers, arrived at Robinvale at a time of expansion of the grape-growing industry.
When we came here in 54, 55, there was a lot of migration into Australia, and a lot of the migrants were coming from the Eastern European countries. And they would come up here and put the first of their lifestyle in Australia into picking grapes. What they used to do was to bring a train up from Melbourne full of these people, and they'd arrive on the station here at 12 o'clock at night or thereabouts. And then the settlers would go in and they'd stand on the railway station and be allocated these men. Names were called out, men were called out.
How many do you want?
How many do you want? Five, right, there you are, take that slot. And it was really interesting. And then later on, when they came up in daylight hours, it was better because they were able to move over to the Robinvale Co-op and be allocated out over there.
A lot of these young men were only 18-year-old, and some of them were quite homeless, and they'd been on the boat to come to Australia. They hadn't spoken to an Australian. They came straight to Robinvale from the boat onto the train, and usually it was the settler's wife who gave them their first meal because there was very little food available from Melbourne to Robinvale, and they were very grateful.
John Caters is a Swan Hill Shire councillor who lives at Robinvale.
Robinvale had its ups and downs because Robinvale was a thriving little township because of the dry fruit industry that was in Robinvale because of the returned soldier settlements that, of course, that was opened up here. And, of course, there were Italians here before us from the 20s and 30s. They grew tobacco out Happy Valley, southwest of Robinvale. There was a horticulture of tomatoes, vegetables and all that sort of thing, which we were taking to the Victoria market. And, of course, after that, we started putting permanent plantings with dry fruit and wine groves. And after a certain time, that in the middle of the 70s, the dry fruit seems to disintegrate because of the cheap imports that were coming from Turkey, Greece, and whatever have you. So our local co-op, which was the receiver point of all the dry fruit that was grown here in Romba, collapsed, closed down, 200-odd jobs were lost. Decentralisation was talked about then, but it went the wrong way. So Roma lost a lot of economic benefit that was coming out of government coffers, if I can put it that way. And our hospital virtually closed down most of its services. They would have to go to Mildura. And after a while, the Italian and Greek community that we had, and they were in the dry fruit business, invented the table grape industry virtually themselves here. And of course, the new technology came in, had to, what we call, blow up the grapes, expand their sizes. Instead of just turning them into sultans, you turn them into Thompson seedless, which is very sought after grapes. Of course, new varieties came from America and that. And our people here firstly invented the how we can hold grapes on the vines a lot longer now with the plastic covers we have here and the new trellising, V-trellis and slope trellis and all this sort of thing. Of course, we've got huge cool rooms here. If the markets, international markets or local markets, aren't very strong, we can hold the grapes for a long time. So the industry virtually picked up again, and it's a multi-million dollar industry in Romvale, and of course across the river into Euston.
So they had to reinvent themselves.
They did, and with all due respects to the people of Romvale, they invented themselves. They had no help from the horticultural government agencies or anybody else.
How important is that crossing to the people of Robinvale and Euston, would you say?
Very important. We could not do without it. It's essential, like between the two towns, Robinvale produce, they go to Sydney and Brisbane, especially with the grapes. It used to be a two-way bridge, of course, and once the big truck started, it wasn't very wide. There wasn't much room each side, because some people in cars and caravan would go across it and got a truck on the other side. I think they panicked mostly, because I remember Charlie Nealon one day, like, he was coming across in the truck and his car and caravan were coming, and they were right over and had about this, you know, good 3 feet on one side, and he couldn't get past with the truck and they couldn't get past. So he got out of the truck and told him, "Now, just come and have a look and see what room you've got and get over," which they did. There wasn't much room with two trucks passing. You'd have to pull your side mirrors in to get past.
When we first came here, there was no lights. It was two had to get across that bridge, and sometimes it was trucks. I used to be fairly nervous then, and it was quite easy to take your mirrors off and things like that if you got too close to the edge. But quite a few people lost their mirrors.
Some of the people of my age living in Euston now who still drive but wouldn't drive over the bridge, especially at night, they would not drive over the bridge. They felt too nervous to do so.
At the moment, there's lights on the bridge. You've got two lights and it takes you 4 or 5 minutes for the change. One single lane, and you're stopping there for 10 minutes. It costs truckies money. The environment gets hammered with the emissions of gases from trucks and all that sort of thing. And then you have emergency vehicles such as police, ambulances and so on that have to wait there, or you can get congestion. They can't go past. If you had an emergency run, you've got to go to an operating theatre in Mildura and you've got to go through the bridge, you're in trouble.
What about accidents on the bridge? Do you recall any accidents?
Yeah, there has been accidents on the bridge, but I think it was mostly because of people that were drunk, young people that were going too fast, and of course you had the frost, that we do get severe frost up here during the winter, like you saw this morning, and it can get very slippery.
Sadly, one man who lived in Euston was coming over to work over here, riding his motorbike, and his motorbike wheel caught in the rail tracks, and he was thrown against the steel section of the bridge and killed instantly. It was probably around 1970, because I think the rail tracks were still on the bridge after they'd taken the rails up.
Were the railway tracks still on the bridge when you came, Jeff?
Yes, they were. Yes, they were.
But there hadn't been a train running since 1943.
No, that's quite correct. They left them there. Yes, they were there for many, many years later.
Mm. Why do you think that was?
I don't know. I just don't think they were interested in doing it, using it for a start, because the settlement that they put the rail through for never produced the wheat crops that they expected. Consequently, there was no use for the bridge or the rail, but they wouldn't pull it up. That would have cost money. It was just easy to leave it there.
My main memory was the concern as the bridge started to deteriorate. When we were younger, it was always looked upon as being a good, solid place. But after a while, when the heavy trucks went across it, and particularly if you were out rabbit shooting there, you realised just how much vibration, how much movement there was in the bridge. And we're talking now, many, many years ago. And since then, of course, the rails along the side have got weaker and weaker, and they've now made that a one-way traffic because had a car hit the way it is now, there would have been much protection. So I think for a long while the town's been, probably 20 years, very conscious of the fact that something had to be done, and we've had kind of promises that something will be done, but we're just waiting for it to happen.
After years of patience by the citizens of the two towns, there was finally a breakthrough in their quest for an improved crossing. In 1999, RTA engineer Brian Hansen was appointed as project manager to find a solution to the problem.
My brief was to manage the project, to arrange replacement of that or upgrading of that crossing. I wasn't given any real boundaries, just to say we need to upgrade the crossing. So that basically was my brief, and obviously that was a clean slate right at the start. And my job then was to look at options to upgrade the crossing and then select one of those options and then to go through the environmental assessment processes until we get approval for one of those options to proceed and then move into the construction phase.
I think it's the most wonderful thing that could happen to Robinvale. Yes. We've been waiting with bated breath ever since we heard that they were going to put a new bridge in for us.
What do you think it'll do for the area?
I think it'll open up the area quite a lot, actually, because it makes it so much more accessible to people travelling. And the other point is, I guess there'll be no hold-up on the bridge like there is now with the traffic light.
VicRoads and the RTA are joint proponents for the construction of this crossing. We basically share the crossing because it's a border bridge. By agreement with VicRoads, the RTA is project managing the project. VicRoads are involved all the way through the process, through meetings. We ensure that VicRoads agree with what we're doing at each phase. We involve them in the work, but it is the RTA that's running the project and project managing it.
From the beginning, the community was consulted about all aspects of the location and construction of the new bridge.
We had 10 formal meetings with the community. We set up a community consultative committee. That committee was selected through advertising and receiving expressions of interest from various people from the community. We went through all those expressions and we picked about 14 people to come onto that committee. Ultimately, other people came along to the meetings as well. We did not bar anyone that wanted to come along and they were involved. But we did have the basic core of 14 people on the committee, which included Indigenous representation as well. Out of that, we worked through the route selection process. We looked at all the options. The committee helped us with information and consideration and advice on reports that we did. The committee also had an influence on some of the decisions we made. For example, we were considering having a high-level bridge or a normal-level bridge with an opening span for river traffic. Ultimately, the committee and the community wanted a high-level bridge without an opening span, and that's what we went with. The committee influenced the location of the footway. There's a footway on the bridge. We changed it from one side of the bridge to the other as a result of input. The committee was very concerned all the way through on making sure that the project did go ahead. There was always concern that the funding might be lost in the time that was taken in doing all this investigation work, and that was frequently raised at the meetings, but we were able to assure them that the project would go ahead.
The bridge builders and the community consultative committee finally decided on 6 options for the location of the new crossing.
Option A was the most economical option as far as capital cost goes. It wasn't the cheapest option for transport efficiency, but there wasn't a lot of difference. But there was some advantages in a more direct route between Robinvale and Euston. However, the more direct route involved other impacts which were of serious concern to us. There was impacts on Indigenous cultural heritage and on the flora and fauna because of the areas it was going through.
Now, what were the Indigenous issues that you had to deal with?
The Indigenous community overall favoured option A. They offered fairly strong objections to the other options, mainly because the other options were going through areas that hadn't been disturbed or not as disturbed as the existing corridor. And also they were going through areas close to the river and through potential burial site areas and would involve the destruction of a lot more trees. So basically the Indigenous community preferred option A.
Well, I was called to a meeting I actually heard different stories and whatnot that were going on about the bridge, but there was a town meeting in Robinvale about the bridge and they called me in. I looked at all the options and there was a bloke talking with a telescopic thing in his hand that he could clip it out and point the different options. And so I couldn't handle that anymore because I knew option A was the only. So I said, "Excuse me, Cobber, give us a look at that thing and I'll show you what's going to go down." Because at the time, I still am an inspector under the Victorian Cultural Heritage Act, which is linked to the Federal Act, which gives us priority of right. Within that act itself, it's for an individual to destroy any significant area, such as a midden or a burial ground. It's a 10 grand fine, 2 years in jail, or both. For a company, it goes up to $50,000, 10 years in jail, or both. So it pretty much says where the bridge is going to go, doesn't it? It
limits the options a bit.
It limits the options, doesn't it? Option A is alongside the existing bridge on the downstream side, coming from Victoria. It's the only option as far as anyone that with a spiritual upbringing and finding all the things that an Aboriginal means, the areas and the bush and all that's left. There's not a lot left out there, and what is left is all that's going to ever be, because they're not practicing their traditional way of life. They're not taking out canoes anymore. They're not cutting shields anymore. So what is there is all that's ever going to be, so we've got to protect it at all cost.
The next step for the bridge builders was to produce an REF, a Review of Environmental Factors document, to determine the effect that the new bridge would have on the community and the environment.
We break the studies down into components, and we look at various things such as cost, effect on transport, efficiency. We also look at the environment, such as the flora, fauna, water quality and so on. We also look at socio-economic considerations, such as the effect on the community, and all that is brought together in one report. A lot of the studies are done by specialist subcontractors or consultants, and all those reports are compiled into one document called a REF report. That report then looks at all the issues and justifies the project and lists any mitigation measures we need to address in doing the project, and basically it then is assessed independently, which we then obtain environmental clearance for the project to proceed.
Anne Gill, a Euston resident, was a member of the Community Consultative Committee that had an input into the REF document. She clarifies some of the environmental issues that were discussed.
There was the birds. I've forgotten just exactly what ones there were now that were mentioned, but there was one cockatoo, but in the long run I think it proved that they really didn't nest on the river, they nested out a bit further. There was about six birds that were found there, but they really weren't a problem. Fish was another one. That there was billabongs between the bridge and the town here. One option was to go along the river, but the fish were breeding there, so that was one of the reasons that it wasn't accepted. There were others.
So the fact that there were certain fish breeding there just changed the whole course of the bridge, didn't it?
The
position of it.
Well, it probably helped too that it was a breeding ground. It was breeding ground for a couple of different things, but the fish, I think, were the main ones that they get out into that water and they breed there.
Can you give me a dimension of this bridge? How long is it actually from beginning to end, the span?
The three bridges are, we've got a main bridge which is 670-odd metres long, and about 380 metres of that is box girder and the rest is super T's. We've got two approach bridges. The first approach bridge is about 156 metres long and it's all super T girders, and the second approach bridge is 180 metres long approximately. And each of these bridges is connected by a road embankment and pavement.
So how many lanes does this bridge have, and how many footways or cycleways and so on?
On the three bridges there's two traffic lanes for both directions, one southbound, one northbound. It caters for about 3,000 vehicles a day, so that's quite adequate. On the main bridge we've also installed a 2 metre wide footway which takes people from Robinvale across the Murray River through the floodplain and into the New South Wales floodplain. That will connect up to a picnic area over on the New South Wales floodplain. There's also a proposal that a pathway be connected through to Euston as well. So that will provide a cycle walkway from Euston to Robinvale. The bridge is entirely above the highest flood level. We've designed the bridge that the highest flood level will be below the underside of the deck on all sections. We don't want a situation where the water does bank up against the bridge because of the problems associated with banking up of water upstream, and also damage to the bridge possibly resulting from debris coming down the river and overtopping the road and things like that.
What effect will the new bridge have on the character of the area and the environment around it?
Well, I think the biggest impact they'll have is positive, in that it will provide quick and safe access between New South Wales and Victoria. That's the big impact. We're very committed to providing an aesthetically pleasing structure, and we have urban designers looking at what we're providing to make sure it looks good. We're lucky to have the high sections over the river matched with long spans, so the balance looks right. It looks like a fairly slender structure. We think that's right. We also, the contractor is involved in detailed urban design and landscaping proposals, which we're working on currently. That will provide for very thorough and detailed landscaping of the site upon completion, which will include pathways, tree planting, picnic tables, interpretive art, and so on. And that work is also involving the Indigenous community. We're seeking input from the Indigenous community. One big benefit of the new bridge is that runoff from the new bridge will be contained and taken over into specially constructed basins on the land, which will stop contaminated material from entering the river from the bridge. On the old bridge, obviously, it runs straight into the river, so you've got rubber components and byproducts of fuel and so on the deck, which ends up washing into the river. That will all be contained on the new bridge, so there is a big benefit there.
At the end of construction, Brian Hansen recalls how the bridge was put together.
Once you start building the bridge, obviously the very first things you do is you build your foundations, and that's what happened on this one. Foundations varied from these large steel tube piles to reinforced concrete driven piles, and that allowed the pile caps to be constructed just below ground level or just under the water, and then the piers to be built. Concurrently, they were building the casting yard for the box girder, so that took some months to build because it had to be built very accurately and very strongly to make sure it didn't move under the loadings of jacking and so on. Also concurrently, they had some components constructed off-site. Most of the bridging, except for the box girder, all the bridging, utilised pre-stressed girders, what we call Super T girders. Super T girder was named that way because it looks on cross-section a little bit like a T, although the shape's changed in recent times. And the advantage of that is that the top of the Super T girder is wide enough that they all touch one another, so you can cast your concrete deck straight on top of the girders. They were built off-site in Melbourne, so that was going on concurrently. So for quite a while we had works going on in Melbourne to make these girders. We had concrete reinforced piles being driven on site. We had the box girder casting yard built, and then after it was built we had each segment was constructed one after the other and joined together. So there's a lot of work going on at the time, and I suppose the process was, once we had the piers up and the box girder was constructed, it gradually got jacked out over the piers. Once that was completed, concrete deck went on the top and the parapets and the barrier fencing and so on followed on from that.
There was then the question of what to do with the old bridge.
The original bridges have progressively been dismantled. The second approach bridge was dismantled during the course of the work because the new bridge was on the same location as the old bridge, so that one went very early in the piece. Approach bridge one has been completely dismantled now, and the main bridge over the Murray River is almost completely dismantled. There are still some remnants of the piers in the river which will be removed over the next few weeks, so that work is virtually complete.
All that now remained was to officially launch the new bridge.
On the 7th of October 2006, we had the official opening ceremony. The bridge didn't actually open that day, but we had the ceremony, and that was attended by, some people estimated, conservatively estimated 2,000 people, other people said 4,000 people, but there was an enormous crowd came along to the opening. We had official speeches in McGuinty Park, just on the southern approach to the bridge. And after that was completed, we moved up onto the bridge and we had the cutting of the ribbon and unveiling of the plaque on the bridge. And after that, everyone walked over the bridge and enjoyed the time on the bridge. There was also festivities back in the park all that afternoon. There was also a parade of vintage machinery and vintage vehicles and other things during the opening. So it was a very big day, very successful day, and enjoyed by many, many local people.
Now, the original lift span of the old bridge, there was a plan for that to be put into the park as a monument, wasn't there? Is that still happening?
That's correct. The lift span has been removed from the river, and it is now resting in McGinty Park in pieces. Over the next month or two, this will be assembled and left as a permanent historic display in the park. So we were anxious to try and keep some component of the crossing when we were developing the project, and we felt this was probably the most significant part of the bridge. And luckily, thankfully, we'll be able to retain that as a permanent display.
John Caters ponders what the future prospects for Robin Vale and Euston are likely to be with the new crossing.
Where this bridge is situated, it'll change the whole lifestyle and of this country, of Swan Hill. You're going to have a huge tourism industry coming up this way. Even the reports that were given to us say that the uses of the road and the bridge will go up by 5 to 10%. So it'd be a corridor from here along the Murray, what we call the Murray Valley Highway, from here to Echuca and places like that, that will follow from Bendigo. You're going to find a lot of tourism will come up this way, up towards Mildura, or ride to Ballarat, towards Sydney and that.
So what do you think it's going to do for Robin Vale?
Oh, look, Robin Vale, first of all, like I said, it's going to be easy and quicker for us to access Mildura services. That's going to open up. And the markets that we have are Sydney, Brisbane, into Goulburn and Adelaide and all this sort of thing, and we use the bridge for our trucking. All our produce goes up north, or three quarters go up north, the rest goes south to Melbourne, but most of it, I think, goes to north into New South Wales, Sydney, Brisbane and them places. We have a lot of dry country in southern New South Wales that the bridge will service, and we're talking about grains. They all go south. But look, the bridge is going to be a huge impact on the economy of not only of Victoria, but in New South Wales too.
Brian Hansen concludes.
I think we've achieved a very good project. I think we've got an asset in the community over there that will last for, well, hopefully at least 100 years, which is the design life. So I'm pleased that we've achieved that, and we've achieved that without any significant accidents, and we've achieved that without any significant community concerns or issues. We've got everyone on side. So I think it's a good outcome.
This oral history compilation was recorded and edited by Frank Hymans from original interviews with 16 persons. The project was commissioned by the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority and was completed in 2007. The opinions expressed in the oral history interviews are those of the individuals concerned and do not necessarily represent in whole or in part the position of Vic Roads and the New South Wales Roads and Traffic Authority.